ship's motors smoothed into shrieking agreement. But Johnny's combination was straight down and 6 feet under, hypersonic. At an abrupt 2,000 miles an hour, both ships hurtled toward the Earth. In an instant, Turl apparently realized that this set of console coordinates was sudden death. Johnny could see him in the cabin, moving urgently. With only 500 feet to go, Turl frantically punched in the reverse combination. His ship motors went into a fighting howl. The inertia of the mass carried it down to within 20 feet of the ground before the descent halted. But the force on the hot motors was too great for them to overcome. Both ships burst into an orange ball of fire. Turl's body hurtled out of the door and struck, rolling. The ships struck. With a swing of his legs, Johnny headed downward into a dive. With a thumb on the jetpack throttle, he guided himself to land about 100 feet from the fiercely flaming wreck. Turl was still rolling. 6. Johnny shed his jet backpack. It was almost expended anyway. Not taking his eyes from Turl, he drew the belt gun and slid off its safety. Turl had been on fire for a moment. He was not now. He had rolled it out in the damp spring grass. He was 50 feet away. He was lying motionless. He had a breathe mask on. Johnny approached cautiously. This was a very treacherous beast. He walked within 40 feet. 30 feet. Turl was just lying there, inert. A statement Robert the Fox had made drifted through Johnny's head.
Plan well, but when battle is joined, expect the unexpected and cope with it.
Turl's escape had scrambled their plans. The compound down there was without air cover. The Lord alone knew what was going on. The sound of gunfire was rattling and thudding in the distance. The mutter of flames came from the burning plains nearby. Johnny didn't look. He had his eyes on Turl, watchful. He stopped. 25 feet was close enough. He could not quite see through the faceplate. Turl was singed. There was some dried green blood on his jacket. Suddenly, Turl's hand blurred and a small gun appeared in it like magic. Johnny dropped at the first hint of motion and fired. There was a flash as Turl's gun exploded in his paw. Then he was up and starting to run. There were questions Johnny wanted answered. His first snapshot had been lucky and had hit the gun. He drew a careful bead on Turl's right leg. "Here's one for the horses," flashed through his head. He fired. The leg buckled and Turl went down. The foot stayed twisted in the wrong direction. Johnny walked over to where the exploded gun lay. It was a very slim weapon. Was this what was called an assassin gun? Turl was lying there motionless. "Quit shamming, Turl," said Johnny. Turl suddenly laughed and sat up. "Why didn't you die in the morgue?"
"Animal," said Turl, putting his foot right way too, but carefully sitting quiet under the menace of the gun 20 feet away. "I can hold my breath for 4 minutes.
He was too cheerful. His leg was bleeding through his pants. He was singed. But he was too cheerful. Johnny knew there was something else. He backed up. Moving so that he could keep Turl in view out of the corner of his eye, he glanced around the plain. The compound was behind them, possibly 20 miles. Gunfire was coming faintly from that direction. He knew he should make some effort to help them. Where were the girls? Probably they had gone on. No, there they were. Johnny hadn't expected that. They were coming back. Riding at a slow trot, cautiously, they were coming back. They were about a mile away. It hit Johnny suddenly. The shock of not finding them in the cage, the fear that they were still in that holocaust down there, had stayed suspended. He was swept by a tide of relief. They were all right. Johnny waved his arm to signal them to come on in. Still alert to Turl, Johnny scanned farther afield. One of the pilots that had bailed out had come in this direction. He peered. Yes. There was somebody moving about 4 miles to the south. Hard to see due to camouflage dress, but a trained eye such as Johnny's detected by the motion of things, not only by contrasts. Turl was laughing again,
You'll never get away with it, animal. Cyclo will be into this place in a swarm.
Johnny didn't answer. He waved the girls in. The horses were shying as they came around the burning wreck. Chrissy was mounted on Old Pork, Patty on Dancer. The horses weren't blowing, so their earlier riding must not have been so fast. The girls were unable to believe it was Johnny. Chrissy stayed mounted some distance away. She was ghastly pale. Her neck was raw red from the collar, now gone.
Johnny? Is that you, Johnny?
He looked different in the blue clothing. Patty had no doubts. She sprang from the back of Dancer and raced to Johnny and put her arms around his waist, her hair coming up to his pocket.
See? See? She was shouting back to Chrissy. I told you Johnny would come. I told you and told you.
Chrissy was sitting her horse and crying.
You got the monster,
said Patty, excited, pointing at Turl. Don't get between me and him, said Johnny, caressing her hair but holding the gun on Turl. He should be at the compound. He must not dally here. Johnny didn't want the girls near him in case Turl moved. He had a sudden idea. Chrissy, look down to the south there, about 4 miles. Chrissy took a grip on herself and wiped her eyes. Johnny wanted her to do something. She looked. She tried to speak, then cleared her throat and tried again.
Yes, Johnny.
She looked harder.
It's something moving.
It's a friend, said Johnny. Ride down there as fast as you can whip up Old Pork and bring him back here. Chrissy straightened up. She guided Old Pork well around Turl and then lit out to the south, her hair streaming back as Old Pork raced away. The gunfire was picking up in volume to the south. Being gentle with Patty and walking sideways while keeping a gun on Turl, Johnny got to a position where he could see the compound. They stood on a slightly higher rise than it. In the clear afternoon air, he could see it, in miniature, but vividly. White water was spraying 200 or 300 feet in the air. It looked like a waterfall in reverse. Then he knew what had happened. The automatic fire sprinkler system had let go. Those Scots down there were fighting in a torrent of water. What he was afraid of was that the cyclos would get out a tank or some additional battle planes. He surveyed the sky. It was free of planes. As he watched, he saw a flash of fire, and then the distant boomp came to them, the sound bazookas make. He was not sure the bazookas could get through a cyclo tank. They needed air support down there, and here he was 20 miles away. There wasn't another single pilot in those assault teams. They had committed their all. He shifted the gun impatiently. Turl was sitting there laughing again. By rights, he should simply shoot him full of daylight. But he had a feeling Turl knew something and was up to something more.
How'd the girls get away? Said Johnny to Turl.
Why, animal, how can you doubt me? I promised you I'd let them loose as soon as you delivered the gold. I simply kept my word this morning. I didn't suspect you'd be so false you would...
Come off it, Turl. Why'd you let them loose?
Turl laughed again, more loudly. Patty had gone over to get Dancer, who was wandering off. She was coming back.
I don't know why this nasty old awful thing did it, but just before dawn, he cut off our collars and told us to get on the horses and ride away. We went about 10 miles and hid, thinking maybe you'd show up. We had no place to go. Then this afternoon, the whole place seemed to blow up, bang, bang, and we rode toward the mountains.
Suddenly, Johnny added it up. He spoke to Turl.
So you murdered Char, did you, and left him in the cage with that man knife in him so that man could be blamed for his death? The question is, Turl, how are you going to wipe out the humans?
Turl had been looking at his watch. He reached toward his pocket. Johnny abruptly made him desist.
Just 2 talons, said Turl, holding them up.
Johnny indicated he could, but was very watchful. Turl plucked something that was about 1 foot square from his side pocket, moving very delicately and gingerly under the watchful gun. It was a large remote computer board, thin, familiar in machine operation, but a bit bigger and dirtier than usual. With a laugh, Turl tossed it toward Johnny, who backed up in case it exploded.
You took the wrong remote off me, rat brain.
Johnny stared down at it, not comprehending. The keyboard only had date, hour, and fire on it. It had no stop or correction tab.
It's irreversible, said Turl. Once punched and activated, the board is worthless. This morning, before the semi-annual, I used it up.
Turl glanced at his watch.
In about 10 minutes now, you'll all collect your pay, whether you messed up Cyclo or not.
He went into a gale of laughter.
You are after the wrong remote.
The laughter made him sputter in his face mask.
And here you are, he finally managed, 20 miles away, and you can't do a thing about it, and couldn't anyway.
He pounded his paws in the dirt, he was laughing so hard. 7. At that exact moment, Zut in the underground hangars was almost out of his wits. Ever since that wild recoil had occurred at the end of the semi-annual, things had been in chaos. The rumor had been flying about that it was humans out there.
Men.
Zut knew better. Those silly slugs could do nothing. It was undoubtedly Tallnaps, landing in here from their system. Zut, although his thinking was interrupted every few seconds by curses at Turl, had it all worked out. The Tallnaps had buggered up the teleportation bands to paralyze counterattack, and were in here after the still not inconsiderable mineral content of this planet. There had been trouble with the Tallnaps before, and the last war with them was inconclusive. They were short, about half the size of a Cyclo, and they could breathe almost anything, and were immune to Cyclo gas barrages, worse luck. Therefore, he was rigging a Mark 32 low-flying ground strafer, the most heavily gunned plane in the hundreds of planes in these hangars.
And damn and blast that Turl, he was supposed to be in charge of defense.
And where were the standby alert battle planes? Out in the weather. And where were the tanks? Snug and rusting in the underground tank park. And where were the reserves at other mine sites? Pulled in here. Damn, Turl. There was no fuel cartridge or ammunition supply inside the compound.
Zut was illogical in blaming Turl for this, since it was against company rules to store them inside a compound. They were nearly a half mile from here, and two parties of Cyclos that had tried to get to the dump had been slaughtered. That was another thing that proved it was Tallnaps. The Cyclos who had been hit simply exploded into a pale green flash. Only Tallnaps could invent weapons like that. So he had to scavenge in the old planes and ground cars for half-used cartridges and ammunition charges. Oh, there was quite a bit to be found, but it couldn't be depended on. He had come to physical blows with the two Chamco brothers, blast them. They were readying up a heavy armored tank. Two tanks that had gotten out that violent afternoon had been blown to cinders. So the Chamcos were rigging one of the old brutes of the Basher class, Bash Our Way to Glory. Nothing could penetrate its hide, and its guns wrecked things for miles. The Chamcos were salvaging fuel and ammunition cartridges for it, and they had the nerve, the twisted metal nerve, to maintain that the attackers were Hockners from Duralab, a system Cyclo had completely whipped 200 years ago. The battle had been over who got the cartridges, and that pompous midget Care had come down and given them both half. Another Turl mess. The cartridges didn't fit the Mark 32. Zut had spent valuable time machining a false case around them to get them into the tubes. Damn Turl. He had told his men to move that damn drone 2 hours ago. Damn Turl. Now, here he was. He had found a co-pilot, one of the executives in the draft that had just arrived, rated combat on a Mark 32, named Nup, a dimwit, but that's what you got on an out-of-the-way planet like this, who thought it was a typical Bolbod attack, based on a rumor he had heard in the Kerbango shops lately in the Imperial City that a conquest of the Bolbods was intended. Zit had collected a combat breathe mask, gotten a shoulder bag of extra vials, gotten his sidearms, put spare rations in his pocket, and last but not least put his favorite wrench into the side of his boot, a wrench that sometimes came in handy in any kind of fight or situation. The Mark 32 motors turned over easily. It purred. In no time at all, he would be out there, and that would be the very positive end of this attack.
Damn, Turl.
Zut let off the skid grips and taxied the Mark 32, hit 'em low, kill 'em, toward the firing door. Mechanics leaped to get out of his way. The place was in a turmoil of cyclos trying to get planes ready with nothing, and that damned drone was still standing there. Ordinarily, you could fire 3 planes at once through that door. It was high enough even to add a fourth, but that ancient relic of a gas drone was so wide and so tall it was blocking the whole door. Just what he told Turl.
Damn, Turl!
There was no way he could get the Mark 32 past it. Zut leaned out the door and screamed for the shift foreman. He came rushing up. Zut almost bit him.
Move that damn drone! 2 hours ago, I...
It won't dolly,
panted the foreman. He pointed. 4 dolly trucks had been trying to push it away.
It won't move.
Zut gave his equipment bag a hoist onto his shoulder and sprang down.
You imbecile crunch. The only inside control that thing has is its mag grapnels. Why haven't you let it off? Those big skis are magnetically locked to this platform. Why don't you learn...
It's a very old drone,
chattered the foreman, his wits starting to crumble under Zut's glare. Zut rushed to the door of the drone. It was a huge door, big enough to load a dozen gas canisters at a time. Somebody had put a rolling ladder there, and Zut ran up it, his equipment clattering, and pried at the door. It was locked, an armored door itself the size of a plane.
Where's the key? Screamed Zut.
Turl had it.
The foreman shouted up at him.
We've looked everywhere for Turl. We can't find him.
Damn, Turl.
Have you searched his rooms?
Zut yelled down from the rolling ladder.
Yes, 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 cried the foreman. We...
At that moment, a higher-pitched voice bit into the row of the hangar.
Yoo-hoo!
It was Chirk. Zut stared in daggers of hostility. The cheap twit. But she was holding a single, huge key.
I found this in his desk,
she caroled.
Where are the other keys to this thing?
Shouted Zut.
The preset box keys.
That's the only one there was in the desk,
lilted Chirk. It gave Zut an instant's pause. He didn't want this damned old relic firing itself off in the hangar with no way to get out. But he had to move it. This was the door key they were passing up to him. He glared at the key. 3 toggles, pitted, the shaft almost in 2. Turl could at least have made a new key, but oh no, it was paws off. He shoved the key, all 20 pounds of it, at the lock hole. He twisted it with a curse.
Damn, Turl.
The rusty magnetic clenchers gave. The key fell apart. Zut flung it to the platform below, narrowly missing Chirk. At least the door was open. He struggled to swing it back. Even the hinges were decayed and stiff. It opened to reveal the enormous interior. Zut got a torch. There were no lights in this thing. It was never meant to have a pilot in it. It was just tons and tons and tons of gas canisters, engines, and armor. He thought belatedly he might have robbed some fuel from it. Too late now. He lumbered forward to the control compartment. He had better throw them off. But no, they were armor-locked solid. They couldn't be unset without a key. And this metal wouldn't surrender to anything. It was armored.
Damn, Turl.
He darted his light around. There was the magnetic grip release, the only interior control, put there so hangar and firing people could lock and unlock it when moving it about with tractors. Zut reached for the release brake. Before he could touch it, it moved. He froze, looking at it in horror. Yes, there was a click in the preset box. He dove for the door. The forward jerk of the motors threw him off his feet. He scrambled for the exit. Too late. The hangar door was fleeing by. It was already yards down to the ground. He didn't dare jump. The drone took off, its rusty side door flapping in the wind. Zut let out a shuddering groan.
Damn, Turl.
Well, at least they could get the battle planes out and end the Talnep attack. And all this on half pay and no bonuses. Probably that was Turl's doing, too.
8. Johnny, 20 miles away, saw the drone launch. It was a huge thing. The gas drone? He went ice cold. The flash of an explosion bloomed on the side of it. He knew it would be a bazooka firing. There was a team there to prevent the launching of planes. A second flash against the hull as the boom of the first one drifted faintly to them. Neither had the slightest effect upon the drone. It rose in stately massiveness to 2,000 feet as it turned. Still climbing, it headed northwest. It went by them to the east, looming in the sky, so big it looked close even though 2 miles away. It was ragged and patched and dented, evidences of former combat on its discolored hide. A tense Johnny clocked it at about 300 miles an hour. A battle plane had fired just behind it. Bazooka missiles hit the plane, exploded in 2 flares of light. It continued sedately on its way, following the drone. As it passed over them, he saw it was a different type of battle plane. The Cyclo numbers 32 were on its side, and then the smoke logos of the Cyclos. An escort? The heavy roars beat at the earth. When they had gone, Turl said,
"Why not admit it, animal? You're licked. When the Cyclos counterattack from home planet, you'll already be gone. So why not toss that gun over here and we can make a deal?"
Johnny ignored him. He was carefully tracking the compass course of the drone, relating it to the afternoon sun. He watched it as long as he could as it droned away to the northeast. It was not turning further. "Be calm," he told himself. "Don't panic." "Where's it going first?" he said to Turl. "A battle plane could do 2,000 miles an hour. You can catch it. Be calm."
"Throw the gun over and I'll tell you all about it," said Turl.
Turl's motions alarmed Patty.
"Don't believe anything he says," she pleaded. "He promised us food and didn't bring it. He even made out to us 2 or 3 times that you were dead."
"You'll tell me about it," said Johnny, "or I'll start shooting off your feet."
He aimed his gun.
"Do it," said Patty. "He's a nasty old brute, a devil."
Johnny was glancing in the direction Chrissy had gone. She was taking an awful long time coming back. He couldn't leave the girls out here alone, and certainly not with Turl alive.
"Be calm," he told himself. "You can catch up with it." "All right," said Turl, as though resigned. "I'll give you the places it's going."
"In proper order," said Johnny, raising the gun suggestively.
"You'd get a kick out of shooting me up, wouldn't you?" said Turl.
"I don't get any enjoyment out of hurting things the way..."
"That's because you're a rat brain," laughed Turl.
All this cyclo talk between Johnny and Turl was making Patty very nervous.
"Don't listen to him, Johnny. Just shoot him," she demanded,
grabbing Johnny's gun arm.
"All right," said Turl. "Its first target is the bottom of Africa. The next is China. The next is Russia. Then it is preset to fly to Italy, and then right here."
Good, thought Johnny. He didn't mention Scotland. It's heading over the Arctic on that course. Scotland. That's its first target. And it would be because the Cyclos couldn't get up there, or thought they couldn't.
"Thank you, Turl."
"Good," he said aloud. "For information received, you live a while longer. It would take it 17 hours to get to Scotland.
Look calm. You can catch it."
Chrissy was coming down. They had been hidden by a dip in the plains. The horse was at a walk. And he saw why as she came near. It was Thor. She was holding him upright in front of her on the horse. She had removed her buckskin jacket and used it for bandages. Thor's anti-radiation suit was stained with blood around the left shoulder. She had torn it away there and used buckskin and grass to staunch the blood flow. Thor's left arm was broken, bound in rough sticks for splints. It was he who had been shot out of the sky when he was using the jetpack. With Chrissy's help, Thor slid off the horse. He was gray from blood loss and stood unsteadily. He looked at Johnny ruefully.
"I'm sorry, Johnny."
"It was my fault, not yours," said Johnny. "Ease him down on that rock, Chrissy." Thor looked at Turl. He had seen the monster close up only a couple of times. Thor was wearing a .457 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver from the old base arsenal, loaded with radiation bullets. He suddenly recognized Turl and grabbed for his gun to shoot him.
"No, no," said Johnny. "Keep the gun drawn and train it on him and shoot him the moment he looks like he's going to move, particularly his hands. Can you sit there okay?"
Thor was about 50 feet from Turl. He eased down further and got the gun trained on Turl.
"Now, Turl," said Johnny, "that gun he is holding can put a hole in you a horse could drive through. It has special explosive bullets, worse than your own blast gun. Got it?"
"Be calm in front of these people. You can catch up with it."
He turned to Patty. He gave her the huge blast pistol to hold. He showed her where the trigger was, and she determinedly walked back of a rock so she could support the gun with it.
"I point it like this?"
"And keep it on him."
"You have time," he told himself. "Do a good job here."
"Why not kill him?" said Thor.
"He leaks information," said Johnny.
Turl couldn't understand what they were saying, but he got their drift. Johnny took out a knife and, keeping out of the line of possible fire, made Turl swivel around. He inserted the knife at Turl's collar and cut the cloth down the back. He went around front, watching Turl's eyes for a telltale clench, signaling action, and pulled the coat sleeves off. He ripped the cloth down the side of each of Turl's legs. He darted a shallow stab at Turl when he sought to spring. Turl subsided. Johnny got Turl's boots and pants off. He took his watch, he took his cap. The only thing Turl had left was his breathe mask, and Johnny even took the emergency vials off that. Turl glared. There he sat, his fur matted with sweat, his claws twitching to rake Johnny. Johnny took the belt and made Turl put his paws behind him and clinched the belt as tight as he could around the wrists. Then he took old Pork's bridle and tied the wrists and belt, and then passed the rope under the mask tube. He cinched it up. If Turl tried to wrestle his wrists loose, he would choke himself.
"Do a good job," Johnny told himself. "Don't panic. In a battle plane, you can catch the drone."
He had been working very fast. He now stepped away from Turl and quickly went through the clothes. Sure enough, Turl had two more weapons secreted. A knife and a second assassin gun. Johnny fired a round with the assassin gun. It was silent. The bush he aimed at began to burn. He gave the light gun to Patty and took the belt gun back.
"Let me shoot him now," said Patty.
Thor said to Turl in Cyclo,
"The little girl over there is begging to shoot you."
"I'll be quiet here," said Turl.
"Don't go near him. Light a fire from that wreck over here to the side, Chrissy, so that Thor stays warm and you can see this area." He turned to Thor. "Who was with you?"
"Glenn Cannon," said Thor. "He's over there in the hills somewhere. I think he tried to get closer to the base. I tried to reach him on this mine radio twice. He's got one, but he doesn't answer. They've only got a 5-mile range."
He looked curious.
"Where are you going?"
At that moment, there was an explosion flash at the compound. A battle plane had come out of the hangar and apparently been hit with a bazooka. It soared in a flame ball and crashed at the sound of the bazooka, and then the plane explosion reached them. A second battle plane came out and met the same fate.
"See," said Johnny,
"I'll send back a mine car for you."
"Be calm. At 2,000 miles an hour, you can catch that drone."
The girls looked numbly at Johnny.
But what could he do?
He had meant to send them all to the academy base, but Thor was in no shape to travel at all.
Why not kill Turl?
No, that would solve nothing. Sound calm to these people. The speed of the drone was 302 miles an hour, he remembered from the messages he had taken from the hand of a president 1,000 years dead. A battle plane could go hypersonic at 2,000 miles an hour. Even if it were halfway to Scotland, he could catch it hours before it arrived. He swung up on Dancer. The base was about 20 miles away. Make it an hour or so of hard riding.
We can still make a deal, Animal, said Turl. If you sent uranium to Cyclo, you're really messed up. It's been tried before. They have a force field around their receipt platform, and if any uranium flashes on Cyclo, that force field triggers solid to enclose their whole platform. The flashback occurs at the sending point, just like you saw today. Cyclo will be attacking this place, Animal. You'll need me to mediate.
Johnny looked at him. He raised his hand in farewell to the girls and Thor, and thumped a heel into Dancer, and she streaked off through the declining sunlight. Ahead of him pulsed and flickered the battle at the compound. He had wasted time. He could not have done anything else. Be calm, he told himself. Don't panic. A battle plane could catch that drone. As he raced across the plain, he put out of his mind a thought that kept crowding in. Not all the armed forces of the United States in its days of power had been able to do anything at all to that gas drone. Not with planes, missiles, atomic bombs, or even suicide crashes. You have time. You can catch up with it. Don't panic. Chapter 13 1 One thing at a time, Johnny told himself. Do each thing properly. Each one as it comes up and each one in its turn. He had read that in a book from the Mann Library. He had been looking for cures for radiation, and he found some. And he'd also found a book about how to handle confusion. It came from too many things at once, and that was certainly happening now. The drone, the possibility of a Cyclo counterattack, the outcome of a compound battle still in question. No reports yet of the attacks on other mine sites. One could easily get confused, make a mistake, even panic. Stay calm, one thing at a time. Dancer had been racing flat out southward. That was not the right thing to do. He could founder her. He began to alternate a trot with a run. She was breathing better. The light was failing. Something as silly as a tripped horse could wreck everything. Trot, run, trot, run. 20 miles. They would make it. He had a mine radio in his pocket, small by Cyclo standards. At 10 miles, he began to call Glenn Cannon, Thor's pilot. Johnny spoke into the mic as he rode. At about 11 miles, Glenn Cannon's voice came back.
Is that you, McTyler?
The voice sounded a bit weak. Can you see a running horse from where you are? Said Johnny. There was a long pause. Then,
yes, you're about 3 miles northeast of me. You got Turl?
Yes, but he's all tied up at the moment. There was a silence and then a short, barking laugh. Some of the tension had gone out of Glenn Cannon's voice when he spoke next.
What was he after up there?
Long story. No time now. Just be calm. Johnny said aloud, The girls are safe. Thor is hurt, but all right. A sigh of relief at the other end. Can you still pilot a plane? Said Johnny. Pause.
My ribs are a bit caved in, and I have a twisted ankle. That's what's taken so long getting back to the compound. But yes, McTyler, of course I can still pilot a plane.
Keep traveling toward the compound. Have a light ready to flash. I'll send a mine car for you. They'll need air cover.
I have a light. I'm sorry about the air cover.
It was my fault, said Johnny. Good luck. Dancer alternately trotted and ran. Keep calm. Things were not hopeless. They had a fighting chance. There were bright spots. They had agreed not to blow up the whole compound. The historian wanted the library. Angus wanted the machine shops.
They evidently hadn't sent any radioactive bullets into the domes. Except for the drone and its escort, they still apparently had air control. At 5.5 miles, he began calling Robert the Fox at the compound, hoping somebody was monitoring the mine radio. The schoolmaster answered. Johnny was surprised, for there were several classified as non-combatants. The parson, the old women, the historian, and the schoolmaster. Johnny shortly heard a relieved Robert the Fox. "The girls are safe," said Johnny. There was a pause at the other end as Robert the Fox apparently passed the word along. When the mic opened next, from that end, Johnny heard some cheering in the background. The news was evidently popular.
"We're holding out here," said Robert the Fox. "I have to talk to you about something when you get here, but not on this open line."
Dancer skirted a clump of trees. It was getting pretty dark. "Those apes can't talk English," said Johnny.
"No matter. Still can't talk about it. When will you be here?"
"About 15 minutes, said Johnny.
"Come in through the ravine to the north. There's a lot of heavy return fire near the compound."
"Right," said Johnny. "Are the planes okay?"
"We pulled them back to better cover in the ravine. We don't have pilots."
"I know. Listen now. Have somebody put the following items in one plane. Warm clothing, a robe, mittens for me, something to eat, some plain, non-radioactive limpet mines, an assault rifle, an air mask with plenty of air bottles. I'll be flying at 150,000 feet. There was a silence at the other end, and Johnny prompted, "Got that?"
"Yes," said Robert the Fox. "That will be done."
He certainly didn't sound very eager.
"Send out a couple of mine cars," said Johnny. He gave the locations. "Better send a man or two to help bring in Turl."
"Turl," said Robert the Fox.
"It's the naked truth," said Johnny. "Get that plane ready. I'll be taking off just as soon as I arrive."
A silence. Then, "Will do." He went off the air. About 5 minutes later, a mine car passed him going north in the twilight. It was the parson, one of the old women, and a Scot with his arm in a sling. The parson raised his hand in a benediction. No, it was a salute. They were off to get Thor and the girls and Turl. A great length of hoist chain was flying out behind the mine car. Johnny glanced back. The old woman was carrying a blast rifle. The sound of the fire exchange was getting loud. The spray of the fire system was shooting 200 feet in the air. Under it winked the blue-green of blast rifles. The stuttering orange flashes of assault weapons were plainer in the floodlights that were on all over the compound. Johnny sped Dancer down into the opening of the ravine and pulled to a halt beside the two remaining planes. Streaks of blast rifle shots laced the sky above their heads. The horse was blowing heavily, covered with lather, but not foundered. "One thing at a time," Johnny told himself. "You can catch the drone." 2. Robert the Fox had his old cape thrown over his anti-radiation battle dress. His grizzled hair was singed on one side. His face was composed, but there was a hint of concern. He grabbed Johnny's wrist and gave it a hearty shake of welcome. Johnny looked at the singed hair. "How are casualties?"
"Light," said Robert the Fox. "Surprisingly light. They don't want to show themselves to us. It impeded their aim. And it's like fighting in a rainstorm. Look, you're not wearing anti-radiation."
"That water is washing radiation away as fast as you fire it in," said Johnny. "I have something to do. There's no breathe gas in that drone. I don't need radiation cover."
"Johnny, can't that drone wait until the mine sites have been flattened? It will take the drone up to 18 hours to get where it's going overseas. We tracked it on the search equipment of this plane, which is to say, we tracked the escort. The drone has wave cancellers."
Johnny opened the plane door. It was all ready. There was bread and meat on the seat. An old woman popped up beside him and handed him a cup of steaming herb tea that smelled suspiciously of whiskey. When he looked at her, questioning her presence in this battle zone, she said,
"They can't eat bullets,"
and laughed a cackling laugh.
Robert's hand was detaining him.
We still have radio silence successfully in.
They had agreed to give the remote mine-site attack pilots 12 hours of radio silence to let them finish off the outlying areas with total surprise, if possible.
That's more than they need. We can shorten it, and they can converge on that drone.
It's headed for Scotland, said Johnny. That's its first stop.
I knew.
Johnny finished off the hot drink and started to climb into the plane. The detaining hand again.
There's something I've got to tell you.
When Johnny had stopped to listen, he continued,
We may not have hit Cyclo.
I know, said Johnny.
That means that we may need all the planes and equipment we can get here. They're in hangars, under us. We don't have men enough to take the place by assault, and we mustn't destroy it.
You can work this out with Glen Cannon. You'll have a pilot in half an hour or so. You can bash it in from the air. He made to get into the plane, and again Robert's hand was on his sleeve.
We had a funny thing happen just before sunset, said Robert. A tank surrendered.
Johnny stepped back onto the ground. He might as well spend this time getting into the warm clothing needed at high altitudes, and he proceeded to do so. Go on. Robert took a deep breath, but before he went on, a runner came up to tell him the historian had delivered a new load of ammunition from the academy. Robert told him to see it was passed out. The blast fire needles continued to lash overhead in the now quite dark night.
The tank is a bash-out way to glory. It's down there at the other end of the ravine. Oh, don't be alarmed. It's in our hands. It came out of the garage port and came right straight toward us. We hit it with bazookas, and they didn't even dent it. But it didn't fire back. It went right straight down to the end of the ravine there and threw out an intercom through an atmosphere lock and said it wanted to talk to the Hockner leader. It wanted a guarantee of safety in return for cooperation.
Johnny was getting into the warm boots.
Well, go on. It's a kind of weird scene, continued Robert. When they got a safety guarantee that came out of the tank, they said they were the Chamco brothers. We got interrogation going. They said they knew Turtle had sold out. It seems there was a mine manager named Char, a friend of theirs, who turned up missing at the firing. Well, this Char told the Chamco brothers that there'd been a murder. That Turtle had murdered the head of the planet so he could appoint a new planet head named Care. And that Care, this afternoon, had denied them ammunition for the tank. The Chamcos claim Turtle and Care have sold out to some race called the Hockners of Duraleb, and even launched the drone to wipe out the other mine sites.
I suppose it's mostly correct, said Johnny, except the parts about the Hockners and the drone. The Cyclos have a lot of enemies, but according to their histories, they defeated the Hockners a couple of hundred years ago. Listen, Robert, in all due respect, I've got to be going.
There's more, said Robert the Fox. They haven't got tank and plane fuel in there, and we've cut down 4 sorties of theirs to get to the fuel and ammunition dump way over there. But they have plenty of blast rifle ammunition. We don't have men enough for an assault.
What else? Said Johnny. Sounds like good news, not bad.
Well, it's not all good news. It seems there's 16 levels of compound under us. Each level stretches for acres. Quarters, shops, garages, hangars, offices, workrooms, libraries, supply warehouses.
I didn't know it was that much, but that's not bad news either.
Wait. If that thing were to be hit with radiation, this whole assault force would be blown to bits. We're fighting on a loaded bomb. We must save those planes and equipment if we have to defend Earth. And we need them for reconstruction if we really did blow up Cyclo.
You'll have air support shortly, said Johnny. You can withdraw.
Well, the Chamco brothers say they know what will happen in there, that we'll flood the place with air. They said they knew how us Hockners took the Duraleb system back. They say there aren't enough breathe gas masks and vials, but the recirculating system has plenty. These Chamco brothers are design and maintenance engineers.
They promised to help us if we paid them. They say the whole planet has been on half pay and no bonuses, and they don't want to be killed in an air flood, as they called it.
Johnny had on warm clothing and was finishing a sandwich of oat bread and dried venison. Sir Robert, as soon as you get air support, you can plan something. The Chamco brothers told us the breathe gas recirculating system was exterior to the base and air-cooled, and they were tricked into admitting all one had to do was shoot up the intake pipes from the cooling system and the pumps would fill the whole compound with air.
You got it all solved, said Johnny.
Yes, but we need the intake shot up at long range from the air.
That shouldn't take long. As soon as Glen Cannon gets here.
Well, I think you ought to do it, said Robert. It's not very dangerous, and if you fire from about a half mile off,
I can do that as I take off.
But you should come back down here to verify.
Suddenly, Johnny knew what Robert was up to. Robert the Fox was going to wait until all planes could converge on that drone. And that was taking a chance. The planes to other mine sites might be in trouble themselves.
Sir Robert, are you trying to keep me from making a single-handed attack on that drone?
The veteran spread his hands.
Johnny, laddie, you've done too much already to get yourself killed now.
His eyes were pleading. Johnny swung up into the plane.
Then I'm coming with you, said Robert the Fox.
You're going to stay right here and direct this assault.
A mine car ricocheted into the end of the ravine and came to a halt. The driver grabbed an assault rifle and ran up to the lines to get back into the battle. Glen Cannon stepped down and limped over to them.
Damn, said Robert the Fox.
What's the matter?
Said Glen Cannon, a bit taken aback with the greeting.
I'm all right. If somebody will tape up my ribs and put something around this ankle, I can fly.
Robert the Fox put an arm around Glen Cannon's shoulder.
It was something else, he said. I'm glad you got back alive. We've got a job for you. A lot of them, in fact. The snipers on the old Chinko quarters.
Goodbye, Sir Robert, Johnny said, and closed the door.
Good luck, said Robert, sadly.
He knew Johnny would suicide crash the drone if everything else failed. He didn't expect to see him again. Then he turned and began to issue orders to two waiting runners. He had a little trouble seeing them. Johnny sent the plane soaring out of the ravine, too fast to be spotted and hit, and was on his way to attempt something the combined military powers of Earth had failed to do, and on his way to do it all alone. Waiting until the drone was, 5 hours from Scotland, was cutting it a bit close. If attacks on it did succeed, they might blow gas canisters, and a freak wind could wipe out Scotland and Sweden as well. There was much to be said for attack in force, but even that guaranteed no success, and no one had ever tried a head-on smash at the drone with a cyclo battle plane traveling at maximum with all guns blazing at the moment of collision. As a last resort, that would destroy almost anything. He hadn't said anything about it to Sir Robert. Surely the old man hadn't guessed it.
3. Dunnell Dean was a very happy man. The Cornwall compound of the British Isles was dead ahead, lit up like the one-time cities must have been. They had drawn straws for Cornwall. This was the mine site that sent out hunting parties that made it death for Scots to go south. The cyclos at this place over the centuries had gunned down people beyond count just for sport on their days off. There was even a tale of a raiding party captured and tied to trees and shot tiny bit by tiny bit and man by man for 18 agonizing days, and many tales like it. He and his co-pilot Dwight had drawn the long straw to the envy of their fellow pilots. They had drilled the navigation. No Scot had ever gotten within 100 miles of this mine site in over 1,000 years, and little was actually known of it. But they had absorbed what there was. They had lain all night, quite relaxed, warmly dressed, for stratosphere flying. They had heard the warning horns go for the final firing of the semi-annual. They had piled into their seats, hands waiting at the consoles.
Wide-eyed and thrilled, they had watched Johnny's incredible sprint. Something had gone wrong as he reached the cage, and that part wasn't so good. No rescue. But Johnny had piled down under the edge of the bluff, safe as a wee bairn in his truckle bed, before the blast rifles went. The recoil had been a bit disconcerting, for it had slewed the plane out of position with concussion. But all was well. They had vaulted their plane into the sky on schedule. They had seen the planet-wide radio towers collapse in a tangle of cables behind them, hit by both the concussion of recoil and bazooka fire. A 12-hour radio silence had begun successfully, ample time for the farthest mine site to be reached without any warning. At 2,000 miles an hour, 100,000 feet up, they had shifted the clock and come down to normal cyclo approach levels to a nighttime mine site. There it was. Scanners and view screens alight, they found no sign of hostile action, no guard planes in the air. Lighted steam was coming out of some shafts in the hills that must be 5 miles deep. Smelter chimneys belched curling green smoke. Warehouses stood in bold outline. And there were the glowing domes of the compound, Target 1. But Dunaldine, being Dunaldine, was quick to take advantage of sudden opportunities, even when they were not quite specified in planning. The silly apes down there lit up the whole landing area for him. It gleamed like a bloody stage. They thought he was simply some non-scheduled cyclo flight. Bless radio silence. And Dunaldine saw something else. Strung on massive power poles coming down from the north was their power supply. And right there, in the full glare of the landing area, was the obvious master pole. The freaks cared nothing about an aerial navigation menace. It was the master pole. The lines from the north came down into it. The local light cables all routed out from it to the buildings and compound. There was a big open space for landing and takeoff in the middle of this spider's web. Right at the side of the landing stage was a huge wheel. Dunaldine recognized it. The master wheel that, when spun, withdrew the master bus bar from the circuit. By Dunaldine's opportunist mentality, it was simply too good to miss. Why let them have lots of light while they rushed about manning their defense weapons and trying to get out to their planes? Why not simply throw the whole thing into total chaos? And then go up and, with infrared screens, shoot the place to bits. Their own plane had a wave neutralizer, copied from one stolen from a ground car, and they could turn it on and those apes wouldn't know what to shoot at. Further, if this battle plane took off, it would seem like it was a defense plane. Dunaldine spoke rapidly to a startled but agreeable Dwight. Just as casually as though they were a visiting plane, they landed right beside the big wheel. Dunaldine hitched the assault rifle strap over his shoulder, opened the door of the plane, stepped down, walked over to the bus bar wheel, and gave it its first spin. It all went okay just up to that point, but now a cyclo in a little guardhouse they had not spotted, only 10 feet from that bus bar, stepped out and stared at Dunaldine.
"The Tallnaps!" screamed the guard.
Before Dunaldine could get the assault rifle into position, the guard had closed the door and hit a siren. A bullhorn opened up enough to blast one's eardrums in.
"Tallnap attack! All posts! Tallnaps! Gun positions!"
Regardless of what Tallnaps might be, Dunaldine spun the bus bar wheel so fast it screamed. He realized then why it was so close to the landing stage. They darkened the place for attack precautions, and had a guardhouse right handy to do it. Dunaldine raced back to the plane. He dove in. Dwight's assault rifle opened up as guards boiled out of a stairwell. They dissolved into luminous green flashes. The battle plane soared. Dunaldine threw on the wave neutralizer and infrared screens. They reverted to plan. With guns set to no flame, maximum concussion, they roared across the compound. The domes squashed like punctured balloons. They raced across the lines of warehouses and knocked their roofs flat. For good measure, they made another pass, this time dropping non-radiation anti-personnel bombs. One gun opened up at them, and the plane took a jolt. They flashed down and squashed the gun with a single blast.
and that was the end of the base. The Cyclo Intergalactic Mining Company did not believe in lavishing money on safety equipment in any department, apparently. And hadn't Johnny said something about Turl calling in all the armaments from these bases? From what they could gather, standing by, way up in the air, the creatures in the compound had been unable to get the masks on before the domes were smashed, for there certainly wasn't any mob coming out. They hung around for a while, occasionally knocking out an isolated vehicle and a stray guard. It really was quiet down there after that. Then they saw something on their radar screen. It was an incoming transport. Abruptly, they recalled transport plane engines leaving after the incoming firing. This thing had been slow-poking its way home, and they had passed it. Good. Dunnell Dean, much to Dwight's dismay, landed beside the bus bar and turned it on. They just sat there. The landing lights were now on. Any Cyclo employee left alive was not concentrating on coming out. The transport plane landed. The Cyclos got out, fooled around with baggage. Then the pilot got out. The Cyclos walked in a mob toward the compound. Then they began to feel something was wrong and stopped. The Cyclo pilot reached for his belt gun. Dunnell Dean and Dwight cut them down with assault rifles. Dunnell Dean flew Dwight over to the fuel dump. They knew what fuel cartridge the transport took, for it was a duplicate of the plane that had brought Johnny to Scotland. Dwight got the fuel cartridges. Dunnell Dean brought him back to the transport plane. Dwight took the old cartridges out and put new ones in. Dunnell Dean shot a guard car that had survived and came racing toward them. It blew up. Dunnell Dean got into the air. Dwight flew the transport up. Dunnell Dean shot the master power pole to bits in a fanfare of sparks and flashes. Seeing that Dwight was well clear, Dunnell Dean flew to a point about 10 feet above the breathe gas dump. He dropped a low-yield, lead-shielded, time-fused radioactive mine on it. He soared up and the dump roared in a lovely green-blue flash. He again checked to see where Dwight had gotten to, saw he was safe. Dunnell Dean soared to 10,000 feet, nosed the plane over, sighted, and fired at the explosives dump. It went up like a miniature volcano, absolutely beautiful. He dropped back and verified that the compound had not exploded. This was part of their orders. The machinery and stored planes were apparently intact. With no atmosphere to breathe, and no fuel to fly, with 90% of its personnel probably dead, the mine site in Cornwall was a write-off. That paid for a lot of crimes. Dunnell Dean fell in beside the transport.
"What's a tulnip?" asked Dunnell Dean.
Dwight didn't know either, but Dunnell Dean supposed he did look strange in a Chinko air mask and U.S. Air Force stratosphere flying gear. They had already agreed on a new and wonderful plan Dunnell Dean had thought up. They had almost 6 hours of radio silence left. Orders complete and time on their hands. Dunnell Dean was related to the chief of Clan Fergus, and besides, there was a lass he had not seen for nearly a year. They hoped the other 14 mineside attack planes had done as well. Of course, perhaps not with the same style. They headed for Scotland. 4. Zut had sunk into deep apathy. The gas drone roared on, deafening, cold and dark. That silly dimwit Nup. Zut had thought at first that the engine sounds he heard were just some rattles in this old relic. But after a while, his trained ear could pick the sound out separately from the din in here. He listened in different parts of the cheerless drone, and then at the flapping door. It was the Mark 32. The Mark 32 hit 'em low, kill 'em, heavy-armored ground strafer. Nup was flying escort to the drone? Zut had puzzled and puzzled on it, and in fact had done little else. At first, Zut was all hope. He thought Nup had followed him out of the hangar intending to lower a ladder to the open door and snatch him out of here. But Nup seemed to be utterly unaware of the fact that there was an open door and was flying on the opposite side of the drone from it. True,
Zut had not briefed him at all. The busted lamp bulb had mostly been talking about ball bods and rumors in Cyclo that they were the next target.